Okay, any preliminary questions or issues?
Mr. Stubbs.
Could you go over joint and several liabilities just real quick, a recap of what the mix is? It's a little
Okay. Again, the basic deal for the exam is that on the exam you will be given a statute drawn more or less at random that reflects whatever that particular jurisdiction happens to have by way of a rule for joint and several liability. And as we've seen, the variations on that issue can range from the most defendant-friendly, what I would call pure several liability, limiting a defendant's obligation only to that defendant's proportionate share. That's on one end of the spectrum, all the way to a regime that would be the most plaintiff-friendly, that would retain in all its splendor the rule of joint and several liability. The rule of joint and several liability is a little bit confusing. The term sort of became a term of art, meaning that the plaintiff, it actually probably originated in the area of debts, where you would have the person who was obligated on the debt, or the lender, in effect. You borrow money from a bank, you and other people co-sign some kind of a debt instrument, and you agree that you will be jointly and severally liable. What that means is that the person who has the debt, who has the right to collect, can collect in any, when we say people are jointly and severally liable, it means that the lender has the ability to collect from whatever combination best suits that lender, a little from each, all from one, a lot from one, a little from another. Essentially, the debtors are at the lender's mercy in terms of the method of collection. So the idea of joint and several liability, again, most plaintiff-friendly, would be that the plaintiff can pick out any combination of defendants and make them pay until the debt has been satisfied. So from the defendant's standpoint, obviously, you're most interested in restricting your liability to your individual share. From the plaintiff's perspective, you want a regime in which you can collect the full obligation, and you don't have to make it proportionate or even it out according to that. You can collect more than a defendant's proportionate share if that's the easiest way for you to collect your money. And again, the question is, of those, or typically between those two extremes, it's rare for a jurisdiction to choose an entirely, perfectly extreme rule. Typically, the jurisdiction will pick some kind of middle position to say, well, we'll let the plaintiff have joint and several liability for some purposes, in some cases, but not in others. And then you got to figure out, how does that apply to my particular situation? Yes, yes. And again, the reason, I mean, in theory, you could know nothing about this area and simply read what the statute says, but obviously, as you've seen, statutes are not always written to be the most user-friendly, and so it helps to know what you're looking for before you go into it to be able to kind of verify that your impression of what it means in one section is consistent with what it says in other sections. Other preliminary issues before we have to finish up Chapter 8, yeah. Well, you're providing a wonderful segue into this last section of Chapter 8, which is how do you know when the rules of premises liability kick in? And as we've seen, the rules of premises liability, by categorizing the visitor according to the visitor's status, the first class cabin here is only a rule of reasonable care. So it's not as though premises liability is an area the plaintiff is lucky to be in. It is essentially reasonable care and worse. So it's the defendant who wants premises liability categories to govern the case and reduce the level of care that the defendant is expected to exercise for the plaintiff's safety. And a manufacturer would love to slide into that and take advantage of it, but as we'll see, the rules of premises liability don't apply except to the relationship between landowner and visitor. Okay, well, let's talk about that then. As I've just summarized here, the issue is, well, when do I apply these categories and when do I, in effect, ignore them? And it's always the plaintiff who wants to ignore them, and it's always the defendant who wants to invoke them because of the more favorable treatment that you get when you invoke them. So we start with Herrick versus Wixon, the circus case. Somebody tell us about Herrick versus Wixon. Mr. Bradford.
Defendant owned managed a pen show or a circus, and two young men either snuck in or were let in by the defendant's son who took in tickets, and during the show, there was a firecracker that went off and it struck once the plaintiff, one of the young men that snuck in the eye. And he brought an action against the defendant. However, it was dismissed on the verdict with no cause for action.
Okay.
The defendant said he was trespassing.
Okay, and it actually went to the jury.
Yeah, right.
And the jury ruled for the defendant. The plaintiff complains about the jury instruction, and the gist of the jury instruction was, if you find the plaintiff was a trespasser, then you should... then the only duty that is owed is to avoid willful and wanton injury. The plaintiff, on the other hand, claims that that's a wrong instruction. What does the court say? What's the court's ultimate ruling on that issue?
The court said the plaintiff was there, the defendant knew the plaintiff was there, and therefore there was a duty to the plaintiff, and that he was a trespasser. Think that he was a trespasser and no duty was owed is illogical since he was part of the audience. He saw him before the negligent act happened, before the defendant is jury instruction is wrong.
Okay, and what should the jury have been asked to decide? On what basis should the jury decide whether or not the defendant was liable? Yeah. They said once he was discovered, they owed him a duty of reasonable care. Now, there's some illogic here, but as the court suggests, but I'm not sure I could fully agree with the proposition that whereas trespassers, undiscovered trespassers, are only owed the duty to refrain from willful and wanton conduct, once they are discovered, you owe discovered trespassers a duty of reasonable care. Here's why that can't be. I'm having a backyard party, let's suppose. Let's suppose I have my home is on the Little Spokane River, and on hot summer days, people like to float down the Little Spokane River in their inner tubes or air mattresses or what have you. And there's a little dock at the end of my property, and people periodically who've fallen into the lake or otherwise, or into the river or otherwise, want to sort of rearrange things, get up on my dock, and squeeze their wet clothes out, or recover their equipment and so forth. Now, I have social guests who have come to my home for a backyard picnic. And I see these trespassers, and not being in a particularly belligerent mood, I don't object to them. I see them, and what is the duty that I owe to them with respect to, say, the condition of the dock? Nails that stick up or something else. Supposedly, following the logic of this, I would owe those discovered trespassers a duty of reasonable care. What duty do I owe to my social guests at my picnic? Yeah, only the duty to warn them of hidden peril. Suddenly, according to this logic, I would owe a higher duty to these discovered trespassers than I would to my social guests. That can't be. At least it wouldn't. It would certainly be illogical to think that. Nonetheless, you can salvage the court's opinion here. The court may be quite correct in saying they owed this kid a duty of reasonable care, but not because he's a discovered trespasser and we owe the discovered trespassers a duty of reasonable care. The way to resolve this case is to say it's not a premises liability case. It's a firecracker case. That is, the reason they should be liable to this kid is because they didn't use reasonable care in pointing this, cannon or whatever it was, or the way they arranged it, so that it caused him an injury. It's got nothing to do with the premises. And unfortunately, not every court will make that distinction. As we'll see later on, they sometimes seem to get confused about this. But the first question you have to ask yourself in a premises liability case is, well, is this a premises liability case? Am I suing the defendant because of some condition on the land which injured me? And then the owner can say, well, with respect to conditions on the land, I get to condition your visit upon sort of acceptance of, with respect to social guests, I can essentially say to my social guests, mi casa y su casa. You take my house the same way I take my house. If I'm content to work my way down those spongy steps with the wobbly railing, well, that applies to you as well. But if it's not about premises liability, then I no longer have that ability, in effect, to condition or modify the duty of care that I owe. So again, this whole notion that discovered trespassers are owed a duty of reasonable care doesn't make any sense, really. But the court's decision may make sense, or does make sense, if we sort of rethink what it is we're trying to do. Mr. Jones.
Doesn't it make a difference that the rest of the class, everyone else in there, was owed a duty of reasonable care?
Well, again, yeah, everybody's owed a duty of reasonable care with respect to firecrackers.
Well, in this case...
But if we modified the facts slightly, let's suppose he slips and falls on some... a spilled vat of ketchup that's at the concession stand. He slips and falls on that. Then the duty of care that is owed, if it's about the premises, could depend upon his status. You may say that by the time he got there, he was, in effect, an invitee, but that's the proper question, is what is his status? To the extent it's not about the premises, then we shouldn't be asking about what his status is. It's no different sitting in the audience with respect to the firecracker whether he got there as a trespasser. It's, this point is made more explicit in, you know, in the next case, Humphrey versus Twin State, where again the defendant says it's a premises liability case, and the plaintiff says, "Oh no, it's not." Mr. Gallup.
So are we looking in these cases and determining whether or not the accident occurred due to a blade of land feature or a fixture, some aspect of the structure?
To some extent, always at the risk of confusing you, but sometimes these analogies may help, it is somewhat like the analogy to the parental immunity issue. To the extent that the claim is based upon the parent-child relationship and some breach of the duty of reasonable parenting, then that's subject to immunity. Again, if the basis of my claim is, as landowner, you owed me a duty with respect to the safety of the premises, then it's a premises liability case. But if, as in the parental relationship cases, you can say, you owed me a duty not to make an illegal left turn and get into an accident, it really doesn't depend upon the parental relationship. It happens, child is suing parent, but to the extent you're not relying on the parental relationship, parental immunity doesn't apply. The question is sort of, what regime are you operating within? The premises liability regime says, as owner, you owe me a particular duty. If I can say, I don't care whether you own the premises or not, as in later on when the guy hits him in the mouth with a golf club, the plaintiff says, in effect, it's got nothing to do with the premises. And here again, you could say the person operating the firecracker, cannon, whatever this thing was negligent in the operation of the cannon. Or in the next case, Mr. Ortiz?
Would it also, is it only specific to landlords, or could it be like if you have a company that's managing your property for you, that it's acting as your
people? This gets us a little bit into the rules of, you know, property law about landlords and lessors and lessees and tenants and so forth. Particularly in a residential situation, you as tenant of the property are sort of the possessor, the owner in effect. Go back to Roland versus Christian. The visitor to that lady's apartment sued her as the possessor of the apartment. She's sort of the temporary owner of the property, but there's also a landlord who actually owns the property, who has, particularly in a residential environment, other kinds of duties. I don't want to get into the complications of, you know, commercial leases where you transfer the duty to repair as opposed to residential where you don't. I leave that to another happy day for you all in property law. What I'm trying to keep it simple on the idea of owner and visitor. So there are additional folks out there, additional duties that we may talk about, but for our purposes, I'm simply looking to whether or not the visitor may sue the owner, the person responsible for keeping it in reasonable shape. Okay, let's talk about Humphrey, and again, I think some of these things will come into focus a little bit better. Oh yes, Mr. Griffin, go ahead.
The plaintiff Humphrey was hunting with a friend on property owned by a gentleman named Thomas. The defendant's Twin State Electric. They operated a temporary electric line using the trees on Thomas's property. In October 2020, the structure holding the line broke. The electric line came into contact with the fence. And apparently on the same day, the plaintiff and the friend were traveling a well-worn path and came in contact with the charged fence. The defendant's companion was killed, and the plaintiff was severely injured.
Okay, so when the plaintiff sues the electric company, what does the electric company say?
I believe the claim is and they were trespassing.
Okay, said, in effect, who are you to sue us? Why, you're just a trespasser. And the plaintiff's response to that is,
it didn't matter. I know the court didn't consider the status question.
Right. Not as to you is the plaintiff's response, which would be just as appropriate as if his fellow hunter was carrying his firearm in a negligent way, forgets to put the safety on it, so forth and so on. The firearm accidentally discharges, and the plaintiff suffers this fatal injury. And as he's gurgling his last breath, he says, "My heirs will sue you." And the hunter says to him, "Tough luck, buddy. You're just a trespasser." You know, who are you to call me a trespasser, in effect? Now, again, the electric company is not in a position to exclude the plaintiffs. The electric company is in exactly the same position as his fellow hunter. The electric company owes a fellow visitor to the land a duty of reasonable care. This is beginning to make a little bit of sense here again, that the concept of premises liability is where the owner, who has the capacity to exclude, conditions the visit upon the acceptance of certain kinds of terms. This goes back to the sort of overarching paradigm of this whole section, which is the relevance of relationship, of contract. To what extent does the contractual relationship or lack thereof figure into how we characterize the duty of the defendant to the plaintiff? And again, the defendant wants to condition this to lower the plaintiff's expectations by saying, "You're just a trespasser." And the plaintiff successfully responds here by saying, "Who are you to call me a trespasser?" The owner could claim that. If I were suing the owner because the owner let his fence get electrified, the owner could perfectly well say to the trespasser, "Why should I be looking out for your safety? If you don't like my electrified fences, stop hunting on my land. If you don't like my sulfuric acid, stay out of my pool." But again, the electric company has no basis for making the same kind of argument. Final case in this area, Potts versus Amos, which I referred to earlier. I've already given away all the fun on this one. Again, the defendant is trying to show the plaintiff how to hit a five iron or whatever it is, and as the defendant is demonstrating a good backswing, whacks the plaintiff in the mouth. And through his broken jaw, he says, "You were negligent." And the defendant says, "Ah, but you're just my social guest. I only owe you the duty to warn you of hidden perils of which I am aware. If I had known you were back there, I would not have swung." And again, the plaintiff says, "What's this premises liability nonsense? I'm suing you because you were negligent with a golf club. Whether this occurred in your backyard or on a public golf course or at Guard Sports, the point is, when you're swinging a golf club, a reasonable person will take measures to avoid injuring others. This is about golf clubs. It's not about the premises." And again, as I was saying earlier to Mr. Gallert, I think the way to try to keep these straight is to say, does it matter that this person owns the land? If it does matter, if I have to include that fact to make sense of my claim, well, then it's about the premises. If, on the other hand, The defendant's negligence is something that has nothing to do with ownership. Somebody else could own the premises. This accident could have happened someplace else, and the ownership of the premises is a irrelevant fact for purposes of the basis of the claim. Then it's not a premises liability case. Now, if we think we understand this, always a dangerous position to be in, we should look at the very end here on Zuniga, this note case on page 26. Homeless guy in Seattle, sleeping off a night of revelry, perhaps, on a dock owned by Payless. While he's sleeping there, the defendant's driver is in the dark, backing up a truck, and runs over the plaintiff. Plaintiff sues Payless. Payless says, "Ah, but you're just a trespasser." How should the court decide the question of the duty of care owed by the defendant? If you're the plaintiff, what do you say in response to the defendant's argument? Yeah, it's about driving. Now, what's the standard of care? What would a reasonable person do at 5 a.m. backing a truck up in the dark on a, you know, dock in Seattle? Would a reasonable person be on the lookout for homeless people sleeping on the dock? Maybe, maybe not. But maybe this guy wasn't negligent, but again, the issue before the House is, by what standard of care do we judge the defendant's conduct? If it's a premises liability case, if it's about a danger of the premises and it's the ownership of the premises that gives rise to the claim, then we should employ premises liability categories. If it's about negligent operation of a motor vehicle, then the ownership of the premises and the plaintiff's status should be irrelevant. Plaintiff lost this case on summary judgment, affirmed on appeal. No reference to Potts versus Amos in the court's opinion. Shows how smart I am, right? I would have thought, I was wrong on this. I would have, reading this, I would have thought that the court would say, just like Potts versus Amos, this plaintiff has a claim that is distinct from, separated from, the ownership of the premises, and maybe the defendant, I mean, if you were a jury of Seattle jurors, and the question was, should people be on the lookout for homeless people sleeping on their docks, you might say, no. As a matter of fact, I don't want to pay more at Payless because they're getting sued by homeless people. But again, that's the issue that they would face, is the question about whether they used reasonable care or not. Why the court didn't even reference Potts versus Amos even to distinguish it, I don't know. Redmo.
Can be it's a loading dock. I mean, the premises itself, the whole purpose for it being there is the trucks can move on and off it and load it itself. Wouldn't that make a premises liability case by virtue of...
I would say the justice in Potts versus Amos, the question is, am I suing this person because of the way they kept their premises? If, for example, I said the owner should have posted signs saying, warning, trucks moving in and out, set your alarm for 4:30. If it's about, you know, the condition of the premises that I'm saying, but if instead I'm saying that a person who's operating a motor vehicle should be watching in their rearview mirror to see if somebody is about to be run over, then whether he's on his own dock or on somebody else's dock is irrelevant. I would say that the plaintiff is just like the fellow hunter in Humphrey. But again, just when I think I've got this, the court sees it otherwise. The court thinks it is a premises liability case. So, again, at the risk of confusing you, what I want you to do is just ask the question. Obviously, the defendant's first response in a case like this is, you're just a trespasser. Go away. But if the plaintiff can successfully avoid that and say, I don't base my claim on the relationship between visitor and landowner, my claim is based upon a different kind of duty, a different kind of relationship. If that can fly, and the court says yes, with respect to that, premises liability is not the defining categorization system. If that's correct, then the court is going to say the duty of reasonable care is unaffected by the plaintiff's status. Mr. Beauvais. Yes. Yep. I would say it doesn't matter, but apparently the court rolled these things together and said, as the owner of the premises, the defendant had, in effect, a defense to an ordinary negligence claim by saying, but you're just a trespasser. Now, I would have thought that argument wouldn't work in light of Potts versus Amos, where the owner said, as the owner inviting you as my social guest, I not only condition my maintenance of the property, but I also condition the activities that I carry on. That when you know, not only mi casa e su casa, but mi golf club e su golf club. So that when I start swinging it around, you accept, you know, sort of this lower standard of care. I don't think that's the law. But the court, I normally don't do this, try to avoid it being sociological about it, but I can't help but think that elected judges in the state of Washington who sit on the Court of Appeals have in the back of their minds, what does it look like when the headline in the paper says, you know, homeless man sues Payless for running over him in the dark? Ah, there goes those crazy judges again. But, you know, that's sort of my cynical sociological attitude. I don't know if plaintiff's lawyer argued Potts versus Amos or not. If the plaintiff's lawyers did argue Potts versus Amos, I don't understand how the court could write an opinion without at least referencing that and explaining why it doesn't control. Again, though, it's too soon old, too late smart, as they say. Okay, let's. Why don't we at least get started with Chapter 9, since we have miles to go before we sleep here. Three chapters in 2.5 days here. I'm going to take the opening part of Chapter 9. Well, I'll just take this first case and then spend some quality time on McPherson. Remember again this overarching paradigm that we're trying to figure out how the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant affects the defendant's duty toward the plaintiff. And what's interesting about product liability law is that the law starts out by saying the relationship is everything. If you don't have a particular kind of relationship, a direct relationship, you don't owe a duty at all. Which is Eventually, the law recovers from this, as we'll see, but it's not the first time we found the law sort of got off on the wrong foot or got out of the wrong side of the bed in the morning, and everything just sort of went wrong. What happens in Winterbottom versus Wright, the defendant repairs these mail carriages, and for purposes of our discussion, might just as well be a manufacturer, sells them to the employer, the post office, who in turn gives it to the plaintiff to ride around in. One of the wheels breaks or there's some other problem with the mail carriage and the plaintiff gets hurt. The plaintiff tries to file a claim against the defendant saying, you defendant negligently repaired or made these carriages and that caused my injury. Garden variety negligence claim. And what the defendant says is, hold on a moment, plaintiff. You are not in privity with me. Now, privity will take on much larger proportions, again, when you're studying property law. Various kinds of rights and obligations for real property depend upon the kind of relationship, horizontal privity and vertical privity and all this kind of stuff. So again, this idea of privity is a kind of direct relationship between plaintiff and defendant. And the court says, why, the plaintiff doesn't have any direct relationship with the defendant. The plaintiff's only relationship is by way of the plaintiff's relationship with his employer. And that's not good enough. Unless there is a contractual relationship, privity, there is no duty. Why, the court says, if we were to permit this kind of a claim, a passerby injured when the carriage collapses and causes injury, why, that person could even sue. How ridiculous that would be. But I would argue that of all people, the passerby has the most right to complain about negligently made vehicles on the road. If you make vehicles that are going to be traveling around on the road, you would owe, I would think, a duty to use reasonable care to prevent them from causing injury to people traveling on the road. To be sure, the defendant could always argue lots of tort defenses, superseding cause. You know, you could talk about all sorts of other reasons why this is not foreseeable. You could talk about all sorts of other standard tort reasons why the defendant shouldn't be held liable. But what's really odd about this case is to say it's not a tort case at all. There is no tort liability. The only kind of liability there is contractual liability. Now, the risk of getting too far out in space here, we've talked before about the extent to which you want to envision the way the law works as a kind of gigantic consensual relationship. Going back to John Locke and, you know, the consent of the governed, and essentially it is a world in which people freely make choices and bargains. And we think it is from that freely made choices that everybody can do the best for themselves in life. Free market, you know, to the max. But again, there's this other regime operating kind of in the same area, same field, which says, whoa, wait a minute. not everything is freely engaged in. Sometimes people have stuff happen to them against their will. They get hit in intersection collisions and things like that. And the law needs to provide a remedy where there hasn't been some kind of freely agreed to relationship. And again, you could, if you wanted to, defend the outcome in Winterbottom versus Wright, not because of the lack of a contract, but actually because there is a contract. You could say that the plaintiff can't recover from the defendant in Winterbottom versus Wright because the plaintiff agreed, in effect, to work for the employer, and the employer agreed with the defendant to take full responsibility for the condition of the carriages. That would make a certain amount of sense. But it would be just the opposite of what the court seems to be saying. It's because of the contract, not because of the lack of a contract, that the plaintiff in this case can't recover. But again, opinions get written, things start moving down the track, and we're somehow stuck with this principle, no privity, no recovery. So if that's the reigning paradigm, plaintiffs are going to be stuck working within a world in which they're trying to get tort remedies, but they've got to phrase it in terms of traditional kinds of contractual relationships. And that sets us up for McPherson. And let's, as I said, spend some quality time here on McPherson, because it's actually one of the classics. Several years ago, been quite a few years, I can't remember when we stopped doing this, but once upon a time we did this in orientation. The first thing you would do, you know, for orientation, you'd read this case, because it was sort of a classic example of judicial reasoning. And it's our... Gee, look who wrote it, our old friend Cardozo. So, can somebody tell me what happens in McPherson? I'll try to do my best. Mike Myers, Scottish accent here. Ms. Reed. Okay, so the plaintiff down here buys the car from the dealer, who in turn bought it from the manufacturer who incorporated these wheels. And what the plaintiff would like to do is sue either the manufacturer or sue the wheel manufacturer for negligently making this product. And the traditional rule was, sorry plaintiff, no privity, no recovery. Unless you have a direct relationship, you're out of luck. And we've seen the same pattern of judicial reasoning before, where the plaintiff says, whoa, that's not an absolute rule. We have made exceptions in the past, have we not? Says the plaintiff. Why shouldn't my case also be an exception to this rule? What are the exceptions that we've made in the past? There are a couple of cases that Cardozo cites as authority for saying the rule requiring privity before some kind of tort recovery is by no means absolute. Okay, that was the... Yeah, Thomas versus Winchester. So in Thomas versus Winchester, the plaintiff buys a poison from the druggist, who in turn buys it from the manufacturer.
And in that case, the plaintiff's able to go after the manufacturer directly, and the court says, well, the lack of privity is not fatal to the claim.
Okay.
Obviously, if you're the defendant in this case, you want to distinguish.
Well, that's Thomas versus Winchester, but that's not the rule that applies in this case because our case is very different.
What, from the defendant's standpoint, is so different about Thomas versus Winchester as compared to this case of McPherson? If you're the defendant, how do you distinguish the case? Say that again? Okay, but similarly, in Thomas versus Winchester, the manufacturer of the drug said, my duty is to the druggist, not to the ultimate purchaser. But they made an exception in Thomas versus Winchester, and if you're the defendant, what do you say is the distinguishing feature about Thomas versus Winchester? What about the product in Thomas versus Winchester created a different result? Why is it the manufacturer in Thomas owed a duty not just to the druggist but to the ultimate purchaser? Well, the people who sell automobiles know that third parties are eventually going to buy these things and use them. Mr. Stubbs? Okay. Ms. Russell? It was destructive by nature. You sell something destructive by nature, says the court, and you owe a duty not just to the immediate purchaser, but to the people that are likely to use it. Cardoza says, okay, that's the rule for things destructive by nature. What do we say about an automobile? What kind of danger does an automobile represent? Its purpose is not to destroy, as the poison was intended to destroy in Thomas versus Winchester, but Cardoza says this product, if negligently made, becomes destructive. Doesn't seem like such a radical departure from the rule in Thomas versus Winchester. Thomas versus Winchester says, you make something destructive by nature, you owe a duty beyond your immediate purchaser to the people likely to get it. Cardoza says, well, you know, it's not so far to say that if you make something like an automobile, which we all know can be very destructive if you don't make it properly. You've also got this case of Devlin versus Smith about some scaffolding or whatever. The scaffolding is defective and causes injury. They say, well, that's okay, because this is something that could really cause injury if it's badly made. Cardoza says, I'm just kind of generalizing the principle here. But notice that when Cardoza does this slight expansion or modification from destructive by nature to destructive if negligently made, he's essentially wiped out the privity rule. Now, as a plaintiff, all you have to show to get around the privity rule is to say, this is a product which, if negligently made, causes injury. And if you're alleging that you were injured through the negligent manufacture of this product, you've essentially, it's your claim that by itself proves that if negligently made, it causes injury. It's hard to think of a case where the privity rule would survive after Cardozo's done with it. Cardoza doesn't stand up on a soapbox saying, this rule is terrible, down with the oppressors, power to the people. But through this process of judicial reasoning, he's essentially replaced a very restrictive rule with a very generous rule. And one of my favorite lines in this opinion
is on page 3 in the right-hand column. We, again, we've seen Cardozo using the royal we, editorial we before. We have put aside the notion that the duty to safeguard life and limb when the consequences of negligence may be foreseen, that this obligation grows out of contract and nothing else. It's not only contract that serves as the basis for liability. We have put the source of the obligation where it ought to be. We have put its source in the law. What is the law? Tort law is the law. You'll appreciate this more when I have competitors out there trying to tell you that other bodies of law are the law. For the moment, it probably seems like tort law is the law. But Cardozo really does put his finger on the problem here, which is, where do obligations come from? Is it only from agreements that people make? Or may society look at people's behavior and say, you can do this and you can't do that, without reference to any deals or lack of deals? So that Cardozo is, again, asserting sort of the, you know, we've replaced the idea that contract is everything, and in comes this body of law that says, did you behave as a reasonable person would have behaved? Did you make this product using reasonable care? If you didn't, we will hold you liable. And the defendant says, but I never signed an agreement to that effect. I never contracted with the plaintiff. I don't even know the plaintiff. Well, so, your obligation is not because you've agreed to something. Your obligation is because we've set a standard, and you didn't meet that standard. And you have no choice as to whether you wanted that standard or not. That applies irrespective of your agreement with it or lack thereof. Now again, I want, at the risk of swallowing a piece of chalk here, at the risk of getting too abstract, I do think that there is a place in which this ties in with very fundamental kinds of ideas, paradigms about the nature of human, you know, existence and the nature of our relationships with one another. To what extent should our relationships be referenced to things people agreed to? And you have the capacity to opt in or opt out of different kinds of regimes. And to what extent does the society say, I really don't care what you think about this, whether you like it or you don't like it, this is a standard you will meet or you will suffer the consequences. And people who've been victimized by other people's failing to abide by those rules are going to suffer the consequences. And as I said before, we are, I would say, speaking sort of as a journalistic observer here, we are conflicted, ambivalent about the extent to which we like this, you know, where we sort of want the best of both worlds. We want the world of contract when it suits our purposes, and we want the world of tort where it suits our purposes, depending upon the issue, depending upon whether we feel like we're in a strong position and can take care of ourselves, or whether we feel like we're vulnerable and at the risk of being exploited. And for different people in different kinds of contexts, you know, it varies. So again, when Cardozo says, we're here, get used to it, we're going to now control the way this body of law works, it's a rather dramatic moment, although it's buried in this, you know, technical opinion, which has to do nominally with the issue of privity, but actually, I would argue, has a more profound impact. And in fact, Cardozo says this again goes to the whole idea of the role of the judge, the role of the, you know, about how the law changes. Again, we don't think of Cardozo as being this fiery radical. He seems like kind of a conservative type. But look at what he's claiming as a judge. Still on page 3, at the bottom of the right-hand column, answering this claim that the manufacturer only owed a duty to the dealer, about 8 lines up from the bottom there, the dealer was indeed the one person of whom it might be said with some approach to certainty that by him the car would not be used. Rather strange sentence structure here. Yet the defendant would have us say that he was the one person whom it was under a legal duty to protect. The law does not lead us to so inconsequent a conclusion. This is nuts, in more common parlance. Precedents drawn from the days of travel by stagecoach do not fit the conditions of travel today. The principle that the danger must be imminent does not change, but the things subject to the principle do change. They are whatever the needs of life in a developing civilization require them to be. Again, Cardozo is saying the law is going to change to adapt to what I think are modern conditions. And some people would look at Cardozo and say, hold on a minute, what happened to the democratic process? How is it you as a judge have appointed yourself to be the person who's changing the law to fit the changing needs of society? I thought that's what we did in our legislatures. Why do we bother to elect legislators and governors and presidents and so forth if the significant things going on in society are going to happen in judicial chambers where you judges sit around deciding, well, yeah, that used to be the rule, but it's going to be different now because we think society has changed. So, again, the question of whether Cardozo is doing the right thing here, certainly you could say the rule of privity was bizarre. But when Cardozo essentially says, the reason I get to do this is because I, as judge, am responsible for making sure the law doesn't get out of step with the way, you know, as we move from stagecoaches to motor vehicles, the law is going to develop as well. And whether you say, good for you, Cardozo, the dead hand of the past is not going to control our destiny, or whether you say, who died and made you God? Again, the question about what the judge is supposed to do. Now, we'll take a break in just a few minutes here, but the last case in this section is sort of the last chapter in the regime of contract. And after that, we will begin the real story of modern product liability law, which is all about tort principles. But we've sort of forgotten that we spent these years in the wilderness of contract law, and we're finally home where product liability belongs, which is in the land of tort. But let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and pick that up.